Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to the Peak Prosperity Show. I am your host, Chris Martinson. You know, a couple of days ago, a key Fed official came out in support of additional asset purchases by the Fed if necessary, which is code speak for print up some more money and hand it to the financial industry. Now, what are we to make of this? Clearly, the world is mired in low growth, and it can be said with certainty that lots and lots of money printing has not delivered us into a future of high or even much higher economic growth. And the cross currents and conflicting signals are driving even the most seasoned of investors I know absolutely batty. So how do we begin to make sense of all this? Fortunately, returning to be with us today is Steen Jakobsen, Chief Investment Officer of Saxo Bank. He has more than 25 years of experience within the fields of proprietary trading, alternative investment. He joined Saxo in 2000. He is now the Chief Investment Officer. Steen, it's a real pleasure to have you back.
I'm very pleased to be back, Chris. Thank you.
Well, let's start with the most anticipated event in all of human history. Will the Fed raise rates in June?
In all of human history, it's probably a little rich, but I like the setup. So I think what's important to realize on the Federal Reserve is that the market right now seems to think that we have a traditional economic-based trajectory of interest rate driven by data watching. I think the Fed is in a very different place. I think Fisher, since he came on board, Stanley Fisher, has been instrumental in addressing the issue that the fact that we have zero interest rate and zero bound has not created the additional momentum to the economy. The trickle-down effect, the wealth effect, is, if anything, the other way around, is make for bigger inequality in society. So I think what we're fed to move either in June or in September, I think this is the biggest margin call in history on the asset inflation. And that's where I really differ from most Fed watchers. Everyone else is, you know, looking at employment, inflation targeting. I don't think Fed is at all there. They are saying, listen, zero interest rate is getting us absolutely nowhere. We think it's very, very important for us to move to a more neutral place. At the same time, we will communicate that we are open-minded to additional programs or whatever needs to be done to secure the long-term growth of the economy. But that will be on the downside, not on the upside. And as the year has progressed, I think, and I've said this publicly, I think 2015, again, is already lost in terms of the recovery year. You know, people are using the weather again in the U.S. I find it very surprising that you have winters in the U.S., and it tends to surprise all the economists. But it's a bad excuse because, of course, it was only the East Coast of the U.S. that really had problems with the weather, and that's not big enough really to have a material impact on the U.S. economy. So the U.S. economy is simply, again, going to be a 2% economy. And that will take the market by surprise. Why would market will ask in September when the hike comes, why are you hiking interest rate when growth is below target, inflation below target? Well, the response will be because this is the biggest asset inflation we've seen in human history, and we need to address it.
Well, they certainly seem to be nervous about it because another Fed official came out yesterday and said that when they raise rates, of course, they are going to watch and see how the market responds. They're getting much more direct in being clear about saying that they are watching the market somewhat nervously. Do you share that perception?
Yeah, and we've been warned. Don't forget that the regulation, the capital requirement driven by Vice Chair Tarullo at the Federal Reserve has been more and more restrictive. So restrictive, actually, that now you probably saw that JP Morgan is selling off deposit accounts because they have too much requirement of capital on them. So the maximum leverage in the U.S. society after all these regulations is 1 to 12. We are down from, you know, 1 to 30, 1 to 20 to 1 to 12. The overall system is being deleveraged. There's already on the regulation side, on the capital requirement side, been a margin call, which, by the way, has driven interest rate, you know, at least 25 basis points lower than would be in a normal cycle because they need these treasuries to set aside for risk perspectives.
So when you say a margin call on assets, decode that for our average listener.
Yeah, so what the Fed is saying is that we have the unintended consequences of low interest rates, which is that money is chasing yield, is going into real estate, which has become overvalued, is coming into the equity markets, become overvalued. And then Fed says, well, we have two choices. We can allow the market to just to run into a bubble, burst the bubble, and start all over again. And then, but they wrongly, in my opinion, believe they can actually micromanage that, even macromanage this. So what they would rather do is what you, I think, in the U.S. calls lean up against the market. They'd rather sort of take some of the excess out of the market by going in and telling in the market, we are concerned, we don't want you to have more leverage, we want you to have less, and we certainly would like to see that market became flat line for a while in terms of return. Which, you know, by all metrics of measurements is actually also the expected return of the stock market. Don't forget 3, 5, and 7 years expected return at the present multiples is exactly zero.
I'm surprised it's that high. When we look at the CAPE adjusted returns, it's in what historically is fairly elevated territory. A case could be made that it could be negative returns.
Depends whether you start your statistics after the crash in the 20s or before it. So I think the main point, Chris, however, is it doesn't matter, you know, where the metrics is, because at zero interest rate, everything is priced to perfection in terms of spreadsheets and calculation. Right. When you discount by close to zero, you have infinity as a return. As I said very often, I can go to my bank manager tomorrow and ask him to buy and operate 100 hamburger stands in a spreadsheet, that would have infinite return.
At 0%, it's infinite.
At 0%, it will have infinite return. All of them, 100 next to each other on the same street.
So let's talk about this going from the zero bound. You know, when we're talking about the Fed raising rates, what are we talking about? My assumption is it's going to be a quarter point, and I think that that's going to be fairly meaningless. Is this really one of the most overhyped moments in history?
I think it will turn out to be, but it will be surprising because they are data watching, not margin watching. And I think the second thing is that they're going to do 25% as a token gesture to show that they are moving toward normalized and they want to keep it. I think the yield curve will flatten significantly. I still think that 10 years and 20 years and 30 years U.S. interest rate is going down. I think 10 year as a target is minimum 1.5 against, I think, 1.9 tonight. And overall, I think the interest rate cycle is still coming down because exactly what I said before, the capital requirement means that banks and pension companies needs in their liability, they need to buy yield. And the U.S., you know, trading close to 2% in 10 years, it's just about the most yield-rewarding bond market in the world, ironically, despite the fact it is the biggest, the deepest, and the most accessible bond market in the world. You know, every single European country in 10 years is pretty much below the U.S. yield now. So people will be chasing yield, but I don't think it will have a material impact on the economy or anything. And it is leaning up against the margin inflation, as I call it. And it is a token hike to show the market that you need to rein in this complacency under which you operate right now.
So, you know, if the usual tug of war is between, you know, stocks and bonds, I noted that Mohamed El-Erian is now sitting in cash, a lot of cash, and his argument seems to be, why sit in 0% bonds when you can sit in 0% cash? Is that a viable move at this point? Do you see a risk to bonds in this story as well?
Not really. As I just said, I think, you know, the there's going to be tambers as a, you know, sort of a replay of that, and people will get nervous. But I don't think, you know, the thing is, Iran is ignoring the fact that there is a huge institutional need. I mean, don't forget that the pension sector is, you know, almost 100% of GDP. So your 401ks, you know, 30-50% of that is in fixed income. They need constantly to be buying. There is a shortage of AAA and AA papers in the world. No, I don't think that it is a matter of, you know, choosing one or the other. I got a lot of press, unfortunately, sort of misunderstood when I in Dubai last week said, well, my advice to anyone would be to take, you know, sell your stock portfolio down to where it was January 1st last year, and then take the cash and take 6 months vacation with your family and spend some quality time, which I guess is pretty much the same thing. Because my argument is the same. What we have right now is that the companies, the companies which are listed, they are taking more and more leverage on board at zero interest rate to facilitate a higher volume and margin. So they have higher, lower volume, lower margin. The only way you can keep up with this game, of course, is to increase your balance sheet leverage. At the same time, your portfolio creates is up 30-40% since last year, so you are also having more leverage. So I'm just pointing out, listen, you can not do anything about getting the CEOs to take less risk because they have to make their own mistakes, but at least at a bare minimum, take the leverage out of your own portfolio so you sit with a nice pot of cash if the market does correct. If it doesn't, you're not really losing out much because, again, the expected return is zero for the next couple of years.
It seems like a great time to take a few chips off the table, go get a drink.
Absolutely, and that is my point. You know, it's sometimes the best advice to anybody is to do nothing. And of course, being Saxo Bank, being an online bank, I'm not exactly popular with management for putting this advice out. But you know, I have to give the advice I believe in and how I do it myself. And I'm certainly, you know, reducing whatever equity I had in my portfolio to a minimum. So I'm scaling back to where I was January 1st last year. I want some exposure. There, you know, energy plays are cheap. And put it another way, I'm advising a hedge fund in London. They do bottom-up analysis, 10,500 stocks in the portfolio. How many do you think is cheap in a bottom-up filtering process in the U.S. right now? How many stocks do you think out of 10,500 developed world stocks is cheap?
Oh, gosh, 1,000?
23.
That's a rather precise number. 23 are cheap.
I can even provide the names, but most of the names are actually in the energy sector, funny enough. So, you know, something like ConocoPhillips would be one, Chevron would be another one. So I find it very interesting that you know, that is the only good thing I get out of actually advising anyone is I get to see some of these reports. And I find it very, very interesting personally because, you know, 10,500 stocks, 23 is cheap, which means the, you know, 98% of all stocks is either fairly priced or expensive relatively to their data they are providing themselves and the economic condition under which we operate.
Well, and there's some that are horribly expensive. When I do my little screen and I ask the question, show me stocks with PEs over 200, I get screen after screen of results.
Exactly. And that is my point. We do not know, we do not have a crystal ball, but there are sometimes in life when it is best, just the best advice you could give anybody, just get off. You know, get up at the next turn and just sit back and take the next bus when it comes in.
So let's get back to these pension funds and their big buying needs. The news recently, which actually did make my eyebrows go up a bit, that Switzerland sold 10-year debt with a negative rate of interest. Now, this is a first in history kind of a move. So you're the chief investment officer for Major Bank. Tell us, how do you process that news?
As long as inflation expectation is below that, it's a tangible and reasonable thing to do because you need the duration in the portfolios. So basically, what if you think about a pension sector or anyone who has long-term liabilities, your problem right now is that your stock market portfolio, your fixed income portfolio, is pretty much at all-time highs, both of them. So that's good. You have a lot of money around, but your in terms of the discounting at zero, your expected liability is just blowing up. And in order to keep up with the blown up expectation for interest rate, for return in the future, you need to be buying yield. The only yield on offer in Switzerland and in Denmark, by the way, is negative yield. But they still buy it because without it, they're going to be short on duration. But they will constantly be short on expected return because they do know, as I said three times now, the expected return is zero. So it's good for now, but it's very bad for the future. And so we're creating this overhang of below par returns for the market to normalize. And in that environment, there are going to be huge pressure on anyone who's involved in asset liability management. Because, again, a 0% interest rate, it makes your assets very, very, very high, but it also makes your future liability infinitely high.
Yeah, let's talk about that for a second, because, you know, you can't crack a paper without reading about some badly underfunded pension program here in the U.S. And this is after several years of you know, near record stock gains, but they're getting zero or close to zero on the bond portion of their portfolio. So they're actually losing ground. So when I crack open these pension schemes and I look at their assumed rate of returns, they're still saying 7, 7.5, you know, somewhere in that zone And obviously they're not getting anywhere close to that. So they're just compounding their difficulties, aren't they?
Well, to be fair to them, they have done 7.5 recently, but the expected return, which they don't see as a reality yet, is different. And clearly, you know, pension funds should be putting more money aside. Instead, what they do is to, again, as I said a few times, they're increasing the financial leverage by borrowing money to buy back their own stocks. So I think there has been a short-term quarter-by-quarter management of the stock price, where at least it should have been 50-50 trade-off between the managing the stock market price and, you know, making deposits into the pension scheme. So if they will remain so, because at zero interest rate, their liabilities is infinite.
Mm. So this is something that, you know, I think got surfaced in Bernanke's, you know, first blog offering, which, by the way, set me on edge a little bit, where he said he was concerned about savers, but, you know, first he had to hurt them to help them, was how I interpreted what he said. We're now 7 years into the hurt part of this story. I don't personally see that there's any chance of interest rates getting back to normal. It's going to take years and years. What's your view?
I disagree, because what we have, and I think last time we talked, I introduced my 2018 model, where 20% of the economy is the listed companies and the banks. Mm-hmm. They right now have a funding rate which is 200, 300 basis points lower than a normal business cycle. That explains why we have very high stock market valuation. The price for that, unfortunately, is that the 80%, what you in the U.S. call the main street, the average company, the average guy, is not having enough access to credit. He's not having enough access to a disposable income and the likes. So as soon as you see money flowing out of paper and into the real economy, Chris, you will have not a one-for-one trade-off between increase in earnings in disposable income and inflation, but you will have a 1-to-3. Basically, you have exponential growth in inflation and growth as soon as you deactivate the model you presently have. And that circles perfectly back to where I started. What Fed and Stanley Fischer is trying to do indirectly is exactly that. He's saying, stop investing in paper and start investing in productivity. So, you know, my advice, which again is very difficult for an online bank like Saxo, is for people to go out and find someone to invest in. You know, look people in their eyes and invest in what they believe in and the heart they have behind the idea they work with. Instead of buying, you know, Nestle in Switzerland at negative interest rate, Swiss interest rate bonds at a negative interest rate, or buying, you know, dividend yields mindlessly in the U.S., which gives you 2% because it's better than fixed income at 1%. You know, that game, you know, we need to understand that to have a productive society, you need to increase your investment into education and productivity returning investments.
Well, you know, in many cases, those productivity investments are leading to perversely what I think is a low inflation environment. So if I robotize my factory and I put all this capital into my robots and I have fewer workers, we're just dead in the water on wage inflation over here. It's you know, workers are getting no traction. And given the overhang in the unemployment side of the story, I think, you know, we've got probably 8-10 million people who are just anxious to jump into that labor pool. How do we get that inflation without wages?
First of all, there's some recent studies out, I can't remember from who, I think it was from Harvard, that shows that actually a lot of these people not seeking jobs is doing it because they're better off financially, one of the reasons. So I think we also need to reset sort of what is people not seeking jobs. Are they doing it, you know, for whatever reason? But taking your point about robots, in Denmark we did a very interesting experiment where the government said, listen, we need to understand this robotics, how does it work? So what it did, they put aside a small amount, let's say it's $100 million, which small companies could then activate and borrow from and to buy robots. And so what was the experience? Surprisingly, Chris, the robotic experience was that, yes, they lost factory jobs, but they gained in marketing, in foreign sales, and everything else, and the company became more competitive. So it was an astonishing success. Probably, you know, the biggest surprise was that the state was actually making money, which they never normally do. But robotics is net going to gain jobs, but it's going to have, as you say correctly, it's going to have 5 to 6 years more of the whole economy rebalancing and reassessing itself. And that rebalancing is slowed down by the 0% interest rates, because that keeps in place the 2080. I mean, the U.S. is has some. I mean, I travel to 30 countries, and I love the U.S. But you have the worst infrastructure I know of. I mean, going on the train from New York to Washington is a disgrace. Most of your airports reminds me of like when I was traveling to Eastern Europe in the 1980s before the wall came down. I mean, think about it. You should be by you. The state, the U.S. government should guarantee every infrastructure. Then you should be able to buy an infrastructure bond for building a railway between Washington and New York, paying your coupon of 4%. That is real investment. That is real jobs on the ground. Instead, you're buying, you know, netbook, net, what are they all called? Net, whatever. And that's the point. You know, we have to own up to, Chris, that we can complain, but we also need to invest where productivity is, and we need the incentive. You know, we need a 3-4% coupon on infrastructure bonds in the U.S. I really think we are making things way too complicated, because there's plenty of jobs, there's plenty of things that needs to be improved. You know, the healthcare sector, you have the most expensive healthcare in the world. There must be ways around creating more jobs, better products, and doing it. I just think we're not ambitious enough. I've been thinking a lot recently, Chris, about when I meet politicians and policymakers, whatever, my response to them at every given question is, you are not ambitious enough. I don't want to hear your semi-max solutions. I want to hear your big-scale grand vision, because we have no people with vision left in the world.
I totally agree. And to me, you know, what's happening in my country, my analysis of it is that we've gotten into sort of CEO worship, that this idea that you know, the people who can accumulate the most stuff somehow, you know, those are the people that we look up to, and you know we'll bid $500,000 to have breakfast with Warren Buffett or something like that. So we have this worship thing going on, but at the same time, what we're seeing is there's this huge gap between what we tell ourselves as a country about where we really are in the world and that train ride that you might take. I mean, if just anybody who drives around this country, you can see all of our bridges have a collective D to D minus rating from the Engineering Association. We still have places which do not have internet. And where we do have internet, my internet is a fraction of what's available in most other countries. We're like 38th on that list. So there's lots of places we could improve. But for whatever reason, making those investments has become a politicized process. I've never seen my political environment more toxic than it currently is. So I feel stuck.
No, you are. But the beauty is, which goes back to my main theory on economics, you need to fail first, you know, in a small way or in a big way. You need, you have potholes in the roads in New York. It's dangerous to drive your car or whatever. I mean, you need people to get so upset that they're willing to commit. But the problem is, our generation, Chris, and the ones before us, We are what I call, we are the entitlement generation. Everything we ever done, we've just been given pretty much. We really didn't have to fight for it. I mean, the generation that came after the war had to fight for rebalancing and had visions. You had great leadership. So I also think that this low interest rate, complacency, update your life on Facebook but don't live in reality. You know, I know it's easy to complain, but everything is so cushy and you're not really being generous. You are not ambitious enough, Chris. I'm not ambitious enough. And certainly the average person is not ambitious enough. I want you to be more ambitious. I want you to show me your best ideas. Stop complaining and tell me what you can do. We need to make a whole movement that says, you know, do not tell me what you can't do. Tell me what you can do, right?
Absolutely. So I've had this idea percolating. You know, we have all this horrible difficulty with our police force, which is very militarized. And it turns out that our police killed more people in March than the UK police had killed in the 20th century. Right. So we have this very aggressive sort of way of policing. And to me, it would be the simple thing is just it's around incentives again. My solution to that would be, listen, if the police want to behave that way, that's fine. But when they lose a civil judgment, that comes straight out of the police pension and it's not made whole or topped off by the taxpayers. Trust me, after the police lose a few million out of their pension, the local police, the retired ones, will all get together and say, we can't have that guy on the force anymore. And it will solve itself. I think market forces could solve this. But we don't, here's my assessment, Steen, I don't think we have market forces in my country. It feels like the political process and corporations and lobbying and money have all sort of spooled together, where I personally, I think that 20 in your 80-20, the 20 has sort of a stranglehold on that. And I don't personally see any way through this before a failure that requires us to say, oh gosh, maybe we should be doing this differently.
No. You know, my number one choice is that the confrontation, the social riot, whatever would happen to start it. But having said that, you know, the reason that is the only solution is that you are too complacent, Chris. You, I know you are very active, and I respect a lot of the things you do, of course. But again, you need to challenge people to be more in the face of people. You need to have incentive structure. You need to be pushing people to go into politics. You know, in Europe, we have youth unemployment 25%. Pretty much across the board. When I go to university, I tell them, you're the most intelligent people, kids ever educated in terms of your at-hand knowledge, but you're also the laziest intellectually. You live your life through update on the social networks. You are not able to conduct yourself in a big room. You're not able to, like Wes. I mean, it's all about just creating the incentives to be better. And at least in America, you have one thing going for you. You are very good at looking at successes. In Europe, it's a little bit different. But Chris, we need people to be ambitious. You know, be ambitious should be the slogan for anyone who runs for president in the U.S. And Chris, U.S. is still a great society. Yes, the market is right there underneath the surface. I have no doubt that the U.S. will come back. Maybe, and that is what I think, the big challenge to the U.S. is actually what's going on in Asia right now with China doing the AIIB bank and the whole Silk Road. That, in my opinion, is the massive wake-up call to the U.S. You failed on the foreign policy to be able to be part of the construction, but this construction will carry $3 trillion worth of orders every single year, which, by definition, by U.S. not wanting to be in it, they are excluded from, at least directly. So I think that maybe that is the challenge, that you need some outside force, you need a stupid Danish economist like me to tell you to wake up, and then you're going to push back against me. Because I think our role, your role, largely is to provoke people to think differently, to get people a little bit uncomfortable, but also for them to push back. Because you live in a great society, Chris. You have to acknowledge that. If not, you are not thankful enough of where you are. But you are underinvested in real things and overinvested in paper things.
I couldn't agree more. You know, I was talking with a gentleman who framed this constellation of predicaments that we face, saying that what they really do is they're calling us to greatness. Like, if we don't bring our very best selves and effort to this, we're going to be extremely disappointed in what happens next. Because you can't open the paper without seeing that ocean fish stocks are collapsing, and where's the phytoplankton going, and these sentinel ecological species are suddenly disappearing, without saying, this doesn't look like it has a great future in front of it, you know? And so that conceit that we can lose these things and ignore them until they really slap us in the face is more a psychological problem than a technological problem, as far as I'm concerned. But the kids today, they need to know that they're stepping into something where they can make a difference. And I see a lot of them feeling very cynical, a little disconnected from the process, and feeling somewhat powerless. That's what I see in my country.
And you will see that across the globe. And the thing is, everything I just said about the U.S., you could say about pretty much the 30 countries I go to on average everywhere. I mean, the thing is, there's no reforms, there's no ability politically to connect, and we have the worst vision ever in history. I mean, that is basically the story wherever I go. So to some extent, my job as the economist part of me is very easy. It is for people, is this call to order, and people to be challenged. And I also think we need to have greater demands on your politicians, on your kids, on the local grocery store, but not in terms of, we need to realize we can't be everything to everybody, Chris. I think the U.S., every single state in the U.S. needs to define what are the three things we're going to focus on. Any politician in the U.S. should not be allowed to talk on more than five subjects. He can have five subjects he really wants to pursue. Everything else has to be left to the marketplace.
Interesting. Well, I'll tell you, I would have a quick list of things that I would be working on, but right at the top of my list would be refashioning the energy infrastructure towards that future we know is coming when we run out of oil, right? And whether that's in 100 years or 500 years or in 50 years, depending on whose numbers you like, it doesn't matter. You know, we're going there and we're totally unprepared for it from an infrastructure standpoint.
So energy, very good topic. So the way you want to do that, of course, is to have best of breed. You have one opinion, you want to have the exact opposite. You will promise me you will go find the guy who has exactly the opposite view of you, big oil or whoever it is. So that's where we need to be. We need to be able to disagree with respect. And the only thing we do now is disagree with disrespect. So the open discussion, the open, really true, what do I believe in, what will I fight for, that's nowhere to be seen in politics, and nowhere to be seen in corporate life either. And I think to some extent, that's why we have this disconnect. We have the inequality being the worst ever in history, and we have corporate profit highest ever. And that is a function of a lot of things, among them, of course, zero interest rate, but it's also a function of people's inability to connect. You know, to be honest, Chris, the stock market, the S&P 500, that impacts 10, 15% of the U.S. population. The rest couldn't care less. But they do care about the 80-20 model being in place. They don't know they care about it, but care about it because Main Street is being hurt, because there is no commitment. You have the police force, as you said, having issues right now in terms of justifying what is happening. All this is a symbol of too little self-respect, too little integrity, and too little accountability, in my opinion. But again, it is, let me stress, this is not U.S. specific. This is a global phenomena, because we pretty much have been playing a game called pretend and extend. Pretend that there isn't a problem and extend by buying time.
So let me go on to that, because I'll tell you what, Steen, personally, I'm growing more and more worried the further the extend part of this program goes. It feels to me like we're just taking one more step up a very tall ladder. And when we do fall off of it, the chance of that really hurting grows. And so, you know, when I look back at everything that I really thought was a problem back in 2008, almost all of them are larger, not smaller today, right? Our too big to fail banks have been enshrined as systemically important financial institutions. They're SIFs now. Sovereign debt is higher, not lower, on debt to GDP, on aggregate amounts, however you want to measure it. When we look at total derivatives that are outstanding out there, which really, I'm not comfortable people really have a handle on how that market's going to behave when things get turbulent. And we have, you know, the Fed just sort of locked into a program of printing and trying to micromanage the market in order to keep expectations with, I think, their fingers crossed behind their back, hoping for growth that hasn't returned. That's how I add all this up. So those to me are larger, not smaller risks. And those risks are just like pressure on a tectonic plate. Sooner or later, you get an earthquake.
Everything you just said is only about the 20%. So the beauty here is that if you wanted to, let's put it differently. If you wanted to reduce inequality in the U.S., there is one simple solution. Make sure the stock market goes down by 50%, then you have less inequality. Mm-hmm. Right? The same argument carries through your argument that the reason you have to be positive is exactly because, think about the economy right now. As you, I think you pointed out yourself, it's never been less market-oriented. What comes next will be a more market-based economy. We know that because that's the only way you can get an economy to function. When I did my economics study, there's only one sentence I can remember from my studies in economics, but it's a very important one. It says, for society to function, you need to allocate capital to the marginal cost of capital. So what it says in common speak is that it says you should only invest, money should flow to where the highest investment return is. Right? Mm-hmm. And that is where the highest productivity is in terms of utility function. We're doing exactly the opposite now. We are allocating capital to the highest nepotism, to the 20%, to the safe play, to the complacent play. So the counter argument to your argument is things are actually so bad that they can't get much worse. If the stock market goes down 30-40%, I'm not bothered, to be honest, Chris. Uh-huh. It's not going to make a material impact on Main Street. If it does mean that people will stop buying stupid dividend yield plays and invest in real capital and real people in SMEs companies and making sure the low credit union gets is the facilitator of the credit, we're in a much better place. You know, we need to stop the 2080 model. That is really everything. And as soon as you do that, you have exponential growth in jobs and disposable income. And with that, inflation will be back at the 3-3.5%. Your saving rate will be up. Your return for the ones that have net savings will be paid, you know, again, 4%, 5%.
Well, what about this view then that the central banks are deathly afraid of a market correction? Because, and this is my interpretation of it, they're afraid that when it gets started, they won't be able to control it.
To be honest, I talk to a lot of syndicates. They know they can't control it, but they would love to control it. They are power people. The only thing that really went well for Bernanke through all his time as chairman of the Fed was the stock market, right? Everything else was wrong. He left the Fed, which where the inflation target is significantly below, where the labor market in terms of the long-term unemployment remains very, very weak. The participation rate the worst ever, the inequality the highest ever. I don't think that is a legacy that goes down in the history books as good. But the one thing he had was the stock market. So the stock market is seen wrongly as the only market which is a true market, because the fixed income market has been distorted by all the quantitative easing and the monetary fanatics that has been going on. But there are no markets, and that is the beauty. You know, when the market comes back, we will have a two-way street. We will have good, the good stocks will survive, the bad ones will disappear, and that's not bad news, too, Chris. That's good news. Would it cost some savers some money again because they get lured in? Probably. But that's for people to realize. What they should realize now is that there's too much leverage in the banking system. There's too much leverage in the corporate world due to buybacks and missing pay-ins to pension schemes. And that is a risk. If people want to play that game, I think they should. I mean, I'm not the one. There's probably a 10% upside, but there is also a 30% downside. Or put differently, we are playing a game of musical chairs, but in the traditional musical chairs, there's one chair missing when the music stops. I think the risk is there's going to be three chairs missing, but it's three chairs. It's not the end of the world.
All right. Well, you know, it's for me, I am worried that this deleveraging will has quite a ways to go, because here's my model. My model says that somewhere in the 60s, early 70s, my country began running up our aggregate debt markets, our total credit market debt, at roughly twice the rate of underlying GDP growth, even faster than nominal growth. And so any school child, I think, could work out with a crayon and a napkin to say you can't grow your debts faster than your income forever. I think we had our first warning shot in 2008. Instead of saying, well, maybe we should not have done that, the Fed has done everything it can to get us back on that credit train. And but it's a mathematically illogical place to be. Can our system function, though, with and here's why I think we're really far up the stepladder. I think that all those years, decades of overborrowing simply represent stored potential energy that needs to be somehow wrung out of the system. I'm worried that wringing out is a painful process of deflation. That's a concern. Is that a legitimate concern?
It is, but you're arguing in terms of the recent past, and we just touched briefly on China. China has $4 trillion worth of reserves, mainly U.S. reserves, which they're going to activate in renminbi into the Silk Road and AIIB, meaning interest rate in the U.S. will go up. It will force people to deleverage. It will force people to save more. The U.S. economy needs to be more self-sustained in terms of its ability to access credit. The U.S. have had the best of all worlds, lower interest rate, lower inflation, and a dollar, which were the main denominator in foreign trade. It's not the case anymore. I mean, unlike, I think Summers was out with a great article recently, and I'm normally not a big Summers fan, but this Silk Road, this AIIB investment bank in Asia, is the biggest tectonic shift in monetary history since World War II, since the Marshall Plan, basically. And the U.S. is left behind. But I think that is a good thing, because the U.S. will now own up, and the U.S. will be back, and the U.S. will be stronger for it. But as you said yourself, I think we agree on one thing. We need to see some sort of a failure in the system for people to wake up. I think it's very close by, and I think we agree on that, Chris.
Great. So if I was going to summarize your position on stocks, it would be the sentence, first the fall.
Yeah.
Something no. like that.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, but you know, take 6 months holidays, 12 months holiday from the market, and play with your kids and educate yourself. It's not the time to be impatient about returns right now.
Well, Steen, this is why you by far are my favorite economist in the world, and I love this conversation. You are absolutely a great thinker, and I love the passion, and I love this idea that what really has to happen here is not figure out how to weasel a couple more basis points out of this or that. It's that we fundamentally have to get back in the game, become engaged, and really take charge of our future, or face whatever future gets delivered to us, and that doesn't seem right.
Yeah, I want the U.S. to be the most ambitious place on Earth again. I think you lost that over the last two decades.
Ambition. I love it. Well, Steen, so for people who want to follow your excellent work, which I do, where would they go do that?
So they can go to Saxo Bank's research platform, which is very easily called tradingfloor.com. And there you will see, and you just, it's free to sign up and people can do that. And anyone you are facilitating, and of course, Chris, you know, I'm very willing to put them on my private email list as well. So anything I can do to help. But understand, I'm always just trying to provoke people to think that I think it's my main objective as an economist, that whatever happens in the world, I cannot control, but I can point out what is wrong. And through my travel experience, I do see a lot of nonsense from policymakers and sell-side guys like myself.
Well, fantastic. Steen, always a pleasure. I love how you think. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me, Chris.